Welcome. You're listening to a Teachers Network podcast, a series that features some of the best minds in public schools today.
Thanks very much, Charlotte, and thanks to all of you for being here today. Small world category to start with. Charlotte mentioned kind of where I started. I came to New York, lived at Teachers College at Columbia, worked actually before in New Rochelle, worked at the what was then called the Agnes Russell Children's School, which at one time Teachers College had a laboratory school. And that was my first real teaching job. But it was amazing to walk in this morning and look in the window and see Debbie Meyer, who I guess may have had to leave, who was my colleague in East Harlem 30 plus years ago when she ran the Central Park East School and I had a junior high school that I was the director of, called then an alternative school. I don't know if it would be called a charter school today. We lived with it, totally within the system. And I was up at junior high 99 up on 100th Street by the East River. And when I left that job and moved into the funded programs office, I ended up writing to our topic today, grant proposals for Debbie Meyer School. So I'll take some credit for the fact that she's a MacArthur Fellow and a, no. Anyway, it's great to be here. This is a topic that's near and dear to my heart, as it is to our three panelists. You can read all of our little bios in your materials, but to my right, John McIntosh, who's at Sea Change Capital Partners, the newest organization represented here, being about, what, a year and
depends
change?
How you
yeah, depends on how you measure it. And we'll hear more about them momentarily. Julia Bator, who's with the Heckscher Foundation for Children, a moderate-sized New York-focused foundation, really focused around children. This year, hoping to make between $12 and $15 million in grants. A lot of them around education. And then Cyrus Driver representing the big daddy of the foundation world, and we're pleased that, well, they used to be the biggest daddy until Bill Gates started giving money to his foundation, but Cyrus is from Ford and works on their education programs, and they're, I don't know, last time I looked, $500 to $600 million a year in grants. A little bit less in education, and obviously not completely focused on New York. They're an international funding organization. So if we could move the slides, we don't have a clicker. So there's our title, Measuring Teacher and Student Success, the Funder's Perspective. It sounds daunting, and we just did that. So let's go to, okay. So I'm gonna try briefly to just do some stage setting and then get out of the way and have the panelists talk about a couple of topics. I was interested when I went to the Teachers Network website to note the vision of the Teachers Network, 27 years in the making, I guess. Our leadership will empower, like that word, all teachers to transform public schools into creative learning communities. So one of our issues today is how do we mesh the idea of creative learning communities with the measurement and evaluation that the world wants and that funders are interested in these days? So every student will succeed and contribute to the public good. Every student. Those are great ideas, and it's wonderful that Teachers Network is supporting that kind of activity. So if we go to the next slide, I then noticed that you had done an online survey about everybody's favorite topic in education, NCLB. And I looked and I thought, 1% find NCLB an effective way to assess the quality of schools. Okay, that's interesting. These are the people who are on the ground in the classrooms every day with the kids, and this act of Congress is supposed to make a difference in public education in the United States, and 1% of teachers feel that it's useful. Sounds like an issue to me. And even more interesting, 69% report that it's pushing teachers out of the profession. I won't be too political. I left the profession, which I've come back to. I'm on the faculty at Baruch College now, but when Ronald Reagan was being elected president of the United States, and I was in East Harlem doing funded programs, and the platform was, we're going to cut all of our education funding as much as we can, which was kind of a precursor to NCLB, I guess, you know, the unfunded mandate concept. You need to do it better, but we're not going to give you the money to support it. That kind of pushed me to think about leaving, and I ended up doing that, and fortunately I've been able to come back, but that's a pretty staggering kind of number. So that's one piece of background. Let's move on to the numbers, the dollars. We do spend a lot of money on public education in the United States. This is from the National Center for Education Statistics, I think. $520 billion revenues, $450 billion expenditures for day-to-day operations. And per pupil, that comes to nearly $10,000, which is increased by 25% over the last number of years. That's a lot of money out there, okay? So everybody should be interested in what effect does that money have, what benefit do kids get from it, okay? Now if we look at the next slide, so what's the position to reflect to our panel today, because they're part of this, where does philanthropy fit into this? Okay, so this is some statistics from the Foundation Center, which, if you had a chance to read the Times this morning, kind of in the middle of the front section, Stephanie Strom, who writes is a Times writer who writes on philanthropy, the Foundation Center just came out with a new set of numbers, and this number is different than the one that's in the Times. So I went back to their website, and I sort of figured it out. The total is not really 19 billion. The total that they announced today is almost $43 billion compared with $39 billion in 2006. The reason, I believe, is that this data is from their grants database, which includes all grants of $10,000 or more. There are plenty that are below $10,000. I used to make a lot of them. And awarded by 1,263 of the largest U.S. foundations. So this is about half, roughly, I would say. But I think it's illustrative. You can see that education is tied with health for the largest percentage of grant dollars. And out of this piece, it's $4 billion and change, okay? Which, you know, if you compare that to the spending on education that was on the previous side, that's less than 1%, okay? So the first point I would make to try to protect our panelists a little bit, foundations don't have enough money to change the whole thing. So that's one observation. A second observation is that, you know, it's important, having said that, to recognize that those dollars can be very creative, to the earlier point about creativity, can be used for creative purposes to find creative solutions to education issues. And that's certainly one of the things we want to talk about today. So we'll go to the next slide. A few weeks ago, if you're not from New York, you may not have seen this. In the New York Times Magazine, how many billionaires does it take to fix a school system? So again, you know, there are resources out there. Some people would say they're enormous resources. We won't start comparing it to the defense budget. But there's a lot of interest in this now, particularly with foundations like Gates, the Broad Foundation. There are all kinds of people who, you know, think that if we focus our money in the right way, we can make a real difference. And this article, again, talks a lot about evaluation and measurement. All right, so quickly, let's go to the next slide. I also pulled up from the foundation websites sort of their mission or vision around education. You can read this yourself. Level the playing field. There's some consistency that you'll see in these. Consistency. Level the playing field for needy youth. Okay, and Julia can talk more about that. Go to the next one. Ford's is longer. That's because they're older and bigger. meaningful citizenship. What did I underline here? Our work supports educational institutions at all levels to expand access, innovate in the classroom, evaluate their efforts, and share best practices. And I think those are all laudable goals, and hopefully goals that we can, you know, work towards achieving. And finally, And John, we'll talk to this later. Sea Change Capital Partners is working in a relatively new field within philanthropy that we're calling growth capital for nonprofits. I've gotten involved in it a little bit myself, but the two primary players that are building this field, and it's relatively new, are the Nonprofit Finance Fund, headquartered in New York with operations all over the country, and Sea Change Capital Partners. NFF has tried to create a program and a system for helping best-in-class nonprofits to develop access to larger pools of capital. Think of it as a venture capital fund. John will correct me if I'm really off base. Venture capital for the nonprofit world. You have a great idea. You've demonstrated in Chicago that you've been successful at making this idea work with measurable difference in the lives of young people. And we should replicate this. We should replicate it in Washington, D.C., Boston, Massachusetts, Los Angeles, California. And under normal nonprofit circumstances, that would take place over the next 10 years. We'll raise $1,000 at a time. We'll put it in a savings account. Eventually, we'll have $100,000, and we'll go open up another branch. You know, why bother? So what growth capital for nonprofits is about is identifying individuals, and the term social entrepreneur will come up in this conversation as well. Basically, people who have large wealth, so far it's largely an individual effort, who can make million-dollar commitments out of their personal funds, and pairing them up with nonprofits that are ready to take that next step. So that's what John is here to talk about. Last slide. Goals for today. These are a little more wordy than I like them to be when I do slides, but we want to talk about, you know, program evaluation metrics for traditional funders, social entrepreneur investors. We want to hear about the perspectives of funders as well as fund seekers regarding metrics. So you're the fund seekers at some point, so I'll be interested to hear your thoughts on metrics and how they impact what you're doing. And then talk about the creativity question, which was on that first slide with the vision of the Teachers Network. To me, there's nothing more inspirational than being in a classroom and seeing a creative teacher do his or her thing with kids and see the light in the kids' faces. That's what it's all about, right? It's not about, you know, the drill and kill kind of approach that we've got this standardized test coming up a month from now and, you know, everybody's looking at the number. We have to do that, but the creativity to me is, you know, that's why I went into it originally. And then finally, how do we sell the concept of creativity in a way that can be understood and acted on by funders? So the way that we want to do this is we're going to start with each of the panelists. We're going to take it in two pieces. One is to ask them first to talk about the metrics evaluation question, how they think about it, how important is it in their grant making. In John's case, as they're, again, he'll tell you more about this, as Sea Change is starting to look at the landscape of terrific nonprofits and identify the ones that they're going to help, is the target for the fund initially like $100 million? That's the stated. They're in the process of trying to raise $100 million of growth capital to support the nonprofit sector. And then we'll talk about, we'll move from that to talking about this issue of creativity and, you know, getting that 69% of teachers who are feeling forced out to rethink that and to stick with it and keep going. So we decided who was going to go first. Did we decide?
I'm not sure we decided, but I'm happy.
Cyrus, you're going first.
Okay, well, thank you, everybody. I'm glad to be here with you. After hearing Michael's initial remarks, I realized it might be useful just to say a couple of other things about the Ford Foundation. Our focus, first of all, Michael mentioned that the Ford Foundation spends about $600 million a year. Our endowment's $12 billion. By the way, the Gates Foundation, once the Buffett money comes in, will be at $80 billion. So, you know, we were once, yes, the big fish. We're getting to be a smaller fish, but still pretty good size. But obviously, you know, there's going to be a lot of money from foundations like Gates and Broad that Michael mentioned coming into education philanthropy in the coming years. The foundation in the U.S. spends, you know, probably on the order of $10 to $20 million, maybe a little bit more on K-12 school reform. That's across the U.S. Our focus, different from those of the other foundations that we've already spoken about, is we have felt that there are many really good educational innovations already out there. There isn't perhaps enough known about how to bring them to scale or how to make sure that they sustain. And one of the key elements that's needed to make that happen is the building of political will. That in fact, it's not just a technical problem, it's not a question of ideas entirely, but it's a question of political will, and that's part of the reason that a number of the equity reforms that we've seen over the past 20, 30 years have come and gone by the wayside because there hasn't been that kind of political pressure to assure that they sustain. And so we have supported a number of efforts around what one might call constituency building for school reform. In my portfolio, a lot of the focus has been on community organizing for school reform. And we have seen some really, I think, important results from that work as one looks to, you know, some of the important policy reforms that have occurred, you know, particularly on the East Coast, for example, in the last few years. The Campaign for Fiscal Equity folks, along with AQE, have been major foundation grantees. We've supported work in Pennsylvania on their lawsuit, which is about to, which is now in legislation and will bring eventually about $5 billion new into Pennsylvania schools, including $1 billion new into Philly schools. So that's the kind of thing that we've been principally interested in. The second thing I should say along the lines of creativity is we've also been interested in this question, I think we'll turn to this in our second question, around how to assure that all children are prepared to do well and succeed in 21st century society, which demands the knowledge, capabilities, habits of mind, predispositions that allows them to be creative, flexible, innovative workers, that allows them to be participants in a very diverse U.S. democracy that's becoming increasingly diverse, and that is occurring in a world where how people learn and think and communicate is changing because of new technologies. I'm sitting over here looking at this iPod and realizing I'm using all my time on these prefatory remarks, but in any case, iPhone, excuse me, it's a beautiful device. I just wanted to give you a little bit of background on the foundation. Let me just say a little bit about the other kinds of things we've done. We have supported model development over the years, and in that case, we've paid great attention to the question of evaluation. In our educational program, in fact, over the past 10 years, we have myself and my former boss, Janice Petrovich, our director of the education program, we have insisted that all of the support that we've given to model development be carefully evaluated, that it be evaluated by third-party organizations, oftentimes by third-party organizations that are seen to have credibility and legitimacy, even though it's cost us an arm and a leg. So institutions like RAND or MDRC oftentimes have been part of supporting these kinds of evaluations. And so we also know, so we have a firm understanding of whether or not the models that we've been supporting have made a difference. There are a number of elements that I would just touch on in terms of thinking about evaluation that have mattered to us and what metrics, I suppose, we've been principally interested in. The first is the logic of the intervention itself or the model development, what one might call the theory of change. What are the expected outcomes that one hopes for based on the theory of change? What does the model developer themselves hope to attain? Secondly, there's some specific parameters that determine the kind of evaluation we would do and what we would hope to see the metrics look like. They have to do with the intensity of the model, you know, how much professional development for how many teachers, how often, in how many classrooms, for how long, those kinds of things. Those are the types of questions that we pay attention to. The scale of the intervention, is it happening in many different places? Is there an opportunity to compare across sites? The consistency of the model, is there an opportunity to consider, again, a cross-site comparison that actually is valid? And then the extent to which the intervention is actually taking place in the classroom. Can we actually assess the outcomes that seem to matter the most publicly these days based on the kind of model that's underway? And I would just like to say a couple of words about two models that we've supported over the last 10 years that exemplify kind of a difference in these parameters and then resulting evaluation metrics. The first is a model called Project Grad that Ford provided probably ultimately about $60 million to over a period of about 8-9 years. It's kind of like and I don't mean this to be dismissive of the project itself, but I like to think of it as the happy meal of school reform. And the reason I say that is because it's, you know, for those of us who have children, you get the happy meal, you get everything in one bag. You know, you get the fries, you get the burger, you get the little toy, you get the whole bit, okay? Although I don't think they give the toy that much anymore. But in any case, the Project Grad is a model built on off-the-shelf programs. Success for All, as I'm sure many of you know, a program called Move It Math, which is a off-the-shelf math curriculum, a classroom discipline model that teachers learn called consistency management, and a Eugene Lang scholarship program. It's a well-defined package. It has intensive professional development for teachers. It's made, as I said, a very cogent and sort of explicitly defined curricular models. It has a high level of coaching for teachers. There's a lot of money that goes into Project Grad in each site, not just Ford Foundation money, but also local match money that occurred in a number of sites. It's a replicable model. It can be like McDonald's spread across the country with the same exact format. And it lends itself, because it's focused on classrooms and on curriculum and instructional practice, to questions about student outcomes. And in fact, the model developers promise student outcomes. And so in our evaluation that MDRC conducted, they looked explicitly at questions of everything from student attendance rate to student test scores. And student test scores in particular were of interest because there's a reading program, Success for All, and there's a math program, Move It Math. They looked at elementary grades because that's principally where the big gains should show up. And then finally, they also took a look at college-going rates and graduation rates, because there's this Eugene Lang scholarship component, and presumably the motivational element of that should have an effect. Compare that to another initiative that I managed called the Collaborating for Educational Reform Initiative, which focused on locally determined, locally driven projects around defining quality teaching in particular places. It was defined by collections of people who figured out collaboratively what was important to them, what needed to be done. They used local resources, university-based resources, et cetera. They came up with their own vision of what teaching quality really meant for them, and in most instances, it went beyond the usual kinds of definitions around experience, content knowledge, et cetera, but oftentimes to questions of cultural competence and so forth. It's very low cost. Ford was investing anywhere from $200,000 to $300,000 per site versus Grad, which typically was over $1 million per site plus local matches. And there, our metrics were much more around the formation of collaboration, the capacity to sustain collaboration, the capacity to clarify visions of teaching quality, the capacity to engage the school system in scalable models that everybody had agreed upon, and ultimately less about actual teaching practice to some extent, I have to say, and student outcomes. I have a lot more to say, but let me stop there because I can see I'm well over time already. So thanks.
I have my minutes.
Please go ahead.
Michael, should we start? I'm Julia Bator from the Heckscher Foundation for Children, and we are a relative minnow compared to the Ford Foundation. But in New York City, we're a relatively big fish. We are a $340 million foundation. Meaning that we're on target this year to give away between $12 and $15 million, as Michael said, in the five boroughs of New York City, and about half of that is toward education. Our charter is children in New York City, and we do everything from health to camping to recreation, whatever, but most of our giving is in education. I think Michael asked me to be here because we create a pretty differentiated panel, which is a nice thing. In general, when someone asks me to be on a panel, I say, yeah, I shouldn't do it because, you know, the Heckscher Foundation is so quirky. And people say, you know what? All foundations are quirky, especially smaller, family, local foundations are quirky. We're allowed to be, right? We have exactly 1.5 people who work on giving away $12 to $15 million a year. We're pretty nimble. We're pretty shooting from the hip, and we're doing the best that we can to evaluate and look at outcomes. But we do not have a giant R&D department. We do not have the capacity in many ways to look at metrics through a microscope, and that's probably a very, very good thing. We think it's a very good thing. Metrics are something that we struggle with as a smaller foundation. I read a lot of education research in order to try to get a handle on what we should be looking at. How can we be the most sophisticated in our grant making? I read the TC record every week when it's emailed to me, and I read an article in March by Robert McClintock. And if you don't know the TC record, it claims to be the voice of scholarship in education, right? It reviews all the latest education research. And there was an article in there which began as a book review of the latest AERA Handbook of Research on Technology, which clocked in at 1,300 pages, something like 8 pounds of educational research. And it was a really beautiful article. It was about this long. And the last paragraph said, I'm just going to read it. It said, in sum, the absurdity. Educational research accumulates in great growing bulk with all manner of contradictory findings and no leverage by which to affect practice in any significant way. Better schooling depends less on research, but on adequate resources for the job, human and financial, and lots of hard work day by day in an ethos of support and high expectation in school and out. Okay? Your teachers. You know this to be the core truth. So that made me feel good about our confusion about metrics. And our ability, you know, as a relatively nimble organization with a lot of money in its pocket, to go around and look at things and to see beyond test scores. And I have no problem with test scores. But part of this has pushed us to look at a bigger picture of networks and models, as Ford talked about. Less at individual schools, less at test scores, and really about networks and models that we believe in. Many of these will come as no surprise to you. We believe in KIPP schools in New York City. We believe in the urban assembly schools in New York City. We believe in Teach for America. We love the Good Shepherd transfer school models. These are things that we believe have real magic in them. Each school is not perfect, each classroom is not perfect, but the model, we believe, is very strong. We do fund some individual schools, but because we believe that they have a seed perhaps to replicate, or maybe even just such a charismatic leader that person is going to move beyond that school in terms of their philosophy. In addition, we're interested in targeting what we see as leverage points, places where private money can hook onto public dollars in a way to really maximize them. Public money often falls short in what it can do and what it tries to do, even good intentions aside, and private money can pump that up to a point where a pilot program or something that's tried can really, really do it the right way the first time. In New York City in particular, we look, some of these leverage points I will also call points of disconnection. We hear statistics all the time about 200,000 children, youth in New York City disconnected, out of school, out of work, overage, undercredited, all these things. So we look at points of disconnection. I'm going to talk about five things that we've done in our grant making recently that are about these points where we think we can have some real leverage as a private foundation. The first one was in District 79, which is the community of schools in New York City alternative high schools. Many of you are probably familiar with them. We initially went to Cami Anderson, the superintendent, and said, we'd like to do some work around suspension centers. You know, kids are leaving the system in droves from suspension schools and suspension centers. They weren't ready to look at that. They said, you know what we're doing? We're building these hubs in every borough, these hubs where kids can go, learn about GED programs, sometimes actually even attach to GED programs right there, and would you be interested in that? And we took that on as a pretty large-scale project for us to fund these five hubs that will serve 15,000 kids this year, kids who some are referred from counselors, but many just wandering in off the streets and saying, kind of think I might want to maybe go back to school. What can you do for me? That's an interesting point for us. And that's a place that's really not about scores or metrics at all. It's about using the GED as a leverage and momentum point to get a kid back in the system where then scores can start counting again. But the outcomes are more about engagement than any kind of score. A second place, which I mentioned before, we're really interested in transfer schools. Again, these are overage, undercredited kids. We like the Good Shepherd model in particular, where kids go into a setting where they can, again, re-engage in their education process. Not maybe what we would want for our own kids, but a place where, again, the momentum begins again and the outcome is re-engagement in the process and not so much about scores. A third place we've thrown quite a lot of money this year is in high school libraries. Many, you know, probably from reading the paper, that many enormous schools in New York City have been broken up into smaller schools, all in the same building. So where you had a behemoth high school of 4,000 kids, now you have eight small schools, all in the same building. And in many of those campuses, as they're called, libraries, gyms, et cetera, were sacrificed. So we have gone in now, I think we're on number three or four, rebuilding high school libraries as points where four, five, six, seven, eight schools can share and there can be community building and you know, some points of networking at the schools. We have funded Teachers College at Columbia to do a large-scale survey of extended time, extended day, extended year models in New York City. We all think that's a good idea. If you ask the folks at KIPPS, you say, why do you do extended day? They say, that's a good idea, and they do it in Japan. Nobody has really done an enormous study of this, particularly in New York City. There's no way to compare apples to apples. So they're looking at that for us because we think there's some real interest there in what you can do when you push the school day out a little bit, and we'd like to be able to publicize that. A fifth thing we've done is to put out a request for proposals to all nonprofits, but again, about half of them that we funded were in education around outcomes management. Strategic planning processes whereby you actually figure out what the heck you want your outcomes to be, hiring of consultants, software, data management, et cetera. I'm just going to end, and I've gone over time as well, Cyrus, is that I'm just going to read you some of the points from our website that when you're going online to put in an application to Heckscher, the questions you have to answer. This is education applicants. And I want you to sort of notice where the evaluation part is and how much weight we give to it. Because these are the things that we think are important. If you are a school or network of schools seeking Heckscher funding, please include answers to the following. How do you recruit students and engage families in your program? Do families pay any tuition and how is this determined? If yours is an independent parochial or alternative program, is your curriculum connected and correlated to the New York City academic standards? If not, what standards do you use? What are your academic achievement results versus the New York City average, and how are they measured? What structural and scheduling decisions have you made to improve student achievement? How is student time allocated across academic enrichment and recreation activities? Where do you get and how do you retain and develop your faculty members? And how does your program connect students to the real world, such as through career exposure, mentoring opportunities, and outside trips? That's the big picture we look at. And then again, because we can, because we're here, because this is our home, we visit, we visit, we visit, we visit, we drive people nuts, we visit. Because you see it happening in schools that have energy and enthusiasm and are doing great things. Whatever their numbers are, you can feel it in buildings, and we really believe that that's an important part of the picture.
First of all, thanks very much for having me here. Public speaking is usually not one of the things that scares me. I stick to heights and spiders and things like that, but being podcast to 1.5 million teachers, in theory, is a slightly frightening thing. On the one hand, I feel like I've been preparing for this panel for years. My wife has been a teacher for 17 years on and off, and now that I'm involved in funding education, the issues of measurement and creativity, and is there a tension between them, and are the funders' perspectives different from the teachers' perspectives, but they're both right, or are they both wrong, is something we talk about a lot. The flip side of that is I'm not a professional educator. I never have been, unlike some of the panelists and Michael. Though I have spent a fair amount of time in the school system, particularly in the UK, with some service work that I've done. And I've also had kids in schools on 3 continents. So sort of, as dilettantes go, feel like I have at least some background. I don't want to say much about Sea Change. For those of you who are here at lunch, you can grab me. The two things I do want to say, because it's important for what I'll say later, is we are funding. We're trying to increase the flow of philanthropic money, donations, from wealthy individuals to organizations working in and around education and development. Not the billionaires who can fix the school system on their own, people who have tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, and who I think see, as all of us in this room must see, that whether you express it as future economic competitiveness, whether you express it as future health of civil society, whether you more depressingly express it as, you know, keeping kids off the streets from doing bad things, particularly low-income children face a staggering situation. And if education isn't the sort of the social justice issue of our time, I don't know what could be. So that's what keeps us going during the day. On measurement, so the first thing for us, and I'm going to use the present tense, even though, as Michael said, we're new, so a lot of what we do is really what we will do, but it makes the conversation more natural. We're supporting organizations, not programs. So that changes a lot of how you look at measurement and metrics. Now, organizations that we look at are delivering programs, but they're not the same. And where we have pitched our tent is really to say there's lots of great funding out there to explore basic knowledge and science, to fund the surveys around longer school days, et cetera. That's great. That's not what we're doing. What we're trying to do is find organizations that already seem to have demonstrated success and help them grow. So it's what I'll call sort of putting practice into theory, rather than funding the creation of knowledge. And obviously we're very reliant, therefore, on people who have done that. And so what that means is a couple of things. First of all, much of the educational research you read about out there on the What Works Clearinghouse, et cetera, is at the other end of the spectrum. They're looking at programs without looking at the organization, because the organization is implicitly the public school system. So if you read about research on, is it whole language learning, or is it phonics, what's better, that's a pure program, because implicitly the organization is schools. We're at the other end of the spectrum. And so for us, any organization we look at already has a mission and related goals that we've accepted, and that mission dictates what measures and metrics are or aren't sensible. So even if you hide behind something like we improve, academic achievement, okay, but for some organizations, the way they think about that is because we stop children from dropping out, or because we make them college ready, or because we actually get them into college, or because we actually get them out of college, or because we improve academic achievement because we think we're effective at making the kids who would otherwise do really, really badly do better, or prep for prep We improve academic achievement because we take the kids who would already do quite well, thank you, and we make them really good. So we try, I think, not to have a one-size-fits-all approach and to say, given this mission, which we've already accepted, what measures and metrics make sense? I think the good news, which we shouldn't lose sight of, is that within education, there's broad agreement about what's good. I mean, graduating's good. Being on plan is good. Attending school is good. Teacher morale and retention is good. There are some things where you might lose some people. Emotional well-being measured through psychometrics. I mean, some people would say. And we probably know what's bad. Truancy, pregnancy, not being on plan. And we shouldn't take that for granted. In the arts or the environment, there's not, to nearly the same degree, I think, a consensus around what's good. I think the bad news is, though, that any of these measures can be abused if you don't remember that what it's a measure of and what it's a measure for are different questions. And let me give you a trite example. If your question is, how should I staff up and recruit my new basketball team, you might be quite interested to know that the better basketball teams have more agile players who are taller and that they make more money. If you wanted to say, how do I improve the basketball team I've already got, using those measures to tell your team, grow taller, and if you do, I'll pay you more, would be obvious insanity. And I think that that sometimes can happen in education. So that, for example, the data set that's come out of No Child Left Behind may actually be very good for some purposes. If structurally you want to understand at some high level what seems to be effective or not, and at the same time be absolutely dire if it comes to measuring or motivating individual teachers in the classroom setting. And it's not because they're bad measures of achievement, it's just that the purpose is different. And the final thing I'd say on that is, you also need to ask why things are being measured. And there's the old story about the drunk who looks for his keys only where the light is. And the easiest thing to measure, I think, is academic achievement. And the data sets are huge, so you can also find a lot of statistically significant results with very low effect sizes. And so that's also something I think we need to keep in mind, that when social scientists are looking for proof, they all want to know that there's really an effect, but most of us say, okay, there's really an effect, but is it big enough to matter? I've got 1 minute, but since bankers aren't creative, I may steal 1 minute from my 6 minutes of creativity and talk another minute on measures. So So for us, there's really three purposes for measures. One is effectiveness. If you're going to ask wealthy donors to give you money to do more of something, their natural question is, well, does it work? And why do you think that? And we need measures for that. But I think for us, it's much more in the should we believe it works, not must we or can we? Whereas social science, again, I think is much more, quite rightly, in the must we believe. Is it so compelling you absolutely have to believe it works? Whereas we're more sort of pragmatic. I take 51% confidence interval of a big effect over 95% in the small effect any day. Secondly is basically cost. What does this thing cost? What does it cost new leaders for new schools to train a principal, and how is that changing? And that's not because we know that it should cost X, and if it costs more, we should do more, and if it costs less, we should do less, but you need to start somewhere. And the final thing is it's just a medium for communication. Organizations need to communicate to their boards and to their funders, and the metrics and measures are the lingua franca of that discussion. And without them, it can't work. Two final comments for 10 seconds. One is this is all an input for us into decision making, not, again, to increase basic knowledge. And finally, legitimate measures can't dehumanize what's really going on, the real world stories, the anecdotes, the problems facing the kids, the hard work that teachers are doing. And I say that for two reasons. One is it's obviously the wrong thing to do. it's a level of abstraction which can be inhuman if taken to the extreme. But more importantly is you lose the donors. I've not met a wealthy donor who has discretion over his money or her money, who views measurement and measures as both necessary and sufficient. You need to have that as the important background. But just from a purely will see change be successful standpoint, in addition to that, you need to tie it into what's really going on. And that can be theory of change, it, I mean, but really. That's it for me.
So I think we didn't plan the order of speaking, but I think this worked out pretty well because I think John really kind of pulled together a number of threads that we were hearing from all three of our panelists on this. Let's move on to talk now about, having heard some of the thoughts on the place of measurement and evaluation in the process, how can we deal with this concept of creativity in a way that will have a positive effect and positive impact both on the young people who are in the classrooms and the teachers who are working with them every day faced off against this world of funding that's looking for results. So should we just repeat the same order again?
Sure, why not?
Okay.
If I could also just build on a couple of things that I heard just a moment ago that I think bear comment. I think you've heard from three different kinds of funders, in a sense. And part of what's implicit, I think, in what we've all said is that, we are all trying to, based on sort of what we're doing, the nature of our foundation, the nature of the place that we work in, our relationship to that place, et cetera, and our relationship to the people who, in essence, sort of control the assets that we're responsible for doling out, we try to find a place. We try to find sort of a ground where we're balancing our values, our willingness to take risks, our interests in doing the right thing, our concerns for social justice, et cetera, and trying to mediate that through a world that really is very concerned with numbers and with the bottom line and with effects and so forth. And so it's a really interesting struggle, I think, for all of us. And I also think it speaks to the sort of idiosyncrasy of each foundation and how it tries to negotiate that kind of that space. So, for those of you who are out there, I think it's really important to get to know sort of where the funder is coming from, where they're situated in this world, because in hearing both of my colleagues here speak just now, I realized there are opportunities for us to intersect in our own work, but they're points of intersection, and it's and it's just really, really sort of fascinating. So anyway, that was just a comment that I wanted to make. On the question of creativity, I said earlier that Ford, and when I say Ford again, I think one important thing to bear in mind is, unlike Julia's situation where it's one and a half people,
closer to the half.
Ford appears large, monolithic, all of one mind. It's really a collection of individual people, and currently we have two people. And I should say that up until a couple of months ago, it was really just me who did nearly all of the K-12 work for the U.S. So we had one person. And in our work on integrated arts education, I was partnering with our Director of Media Arts and Culture, Margaret Wilkerson, a brilliant woman who just recently retired. And we developed work on integrated arts education, which leads me to this question of creativity. I think we have recognized that a key role for schools going forward, as I said before, is to build the imaginative and creative capacities of students. We felt that arts integration is a vehicle for doing so for a couple of reasons. On the ground in individual schools, when it's done very, very well, it becomes a catalyst for really changing the culture of schools in some very profound ways, for making them the kinds of places that Julia described, where you walk into them and you say to yourself, you know, for those of us who have opportunity and privilege to be able to say, geez, I would put my own kid in that school in the Bronx. You know, because it is, you know, it is really interesting, it is really exciting, and these kids are, you know, deeply engaged in learning, and they are beginning to love learning, and that, I think, is one of the key sort of outcomes that we should never lose sight of. The second reason that we've become very interested in arts integration is because we see it as a way, because of the sort of palpable nature of it that, you know, both of you have described, those stories that people can tell when they go into these schools and so forth, because of the palpable nature of it, it has a way of unlocking the imagination of adults who are in charge of schooling, because they can then see what's possible. So people aren't mired in the marginal debates about, you know, should we do value-added measures or should we, you know, stick with the current regime. But let's really start to rethink this enterprise of public education. You know, as we think about our work in arts integration, there are a number of measures that are of interest to us. You know, ultimately, of course, we're interested in these questions of, you know, student, long-term student engagement in schooling, dropout rates, persistence rates, all the way through to graduation, and then their opportunities to go to college and their success and persistence in college. We're interested in seeing you know, as you go into these schools, just as you've described, changes in teaching practice that really motivate students. Oftentimes we look for, you know, if the people who are doing work on arts integration, if they're doing project-based or thematic learning, in what ways is that beginning to engage students, and how is that helping students to learn all of the different subject areas that they're supposed to be learning? We're interested in looking at the nature of relationships between educators and artists, between educators and art specialists in schools, between the adults in the schools. Are those relationships changing? Are they more collaborative? Is there a denser network of people in the school thinking about teaching and learning and thinking about innovative instruction that really moves students? We look at representations of quality through student work, portfolio assessments, and so forth. And are those demonstrating the quality of the work that's improving? And then, you know, finally, we also look at voices of students themselves. There's some really interesting work that Denny Palmer Wolf at Brown has been doing with folks in Dallas at an organization called Big Thought to actually tape students and hear how they speak about their own transformations over time in deeply arts-integrated classrooms as a way to begin to help people to understand the personal transformations that these students are really going through in learning when they've been in. You know, Dallas is a place which was sort of ground zero for the, you know, standards and accountability movement that we're all bemoaning, that, you know, ultimately became manifest in No Child Left Behind. The superintendent of Dallas Public Schools was Mike Moses, who actually was the person who was responsible for the Texas accountability system being developed in the 80s and early 90s, and then became ultimately superintendent in Dallas. And Mike Moses got sold on arts integration because he began to see that something more had to go on, that children's interest and excitement in education was bereft in Dallas schools, and that they needed something much more about really engaging the whole child. The last thing I would just say is, out of this arts integration work, me and a colleague of mine in the higher ed program now, we're beginning to think very carefully about, you know, this moment in time, given that No Child Left Behind was held up, in Congress last year, and for various reasons, there is, we really believe that there is a coming sort of sea change, that the pendulum is starting to swing back. And the question, well, we could talk about it, but from where I sit, I'm hopeful that that's the case. And what we're looking at is the opportunity to begin to rethink, revive, build up alternative assessments, performance-based assessments in particular, as a lever in the way that the reading and math scores have been a lever to move systems, move educational practice in ways that have been I think on balance largely pernicious, and hopefully alternative assessments and performance-based assessments that we see going on in places like Rhode Island and Connecticut and so forth might be able to gain greater currency in the next couple of years, and we're thinking about ways to motivate that on a national scale. Let me stop there. Thanks.
Thanks, Cyrus. Question of creativity. I think this is such a nice match of questions. How do we measure success? How do we support creativity? Two sides of the same coin. It's a place at Heckscher where the scale of our funding changes. I talked a little bit before about how we look at networks and models, sort of a little bit more macro. And when we are working to support creativity, our grant making gets very, very local and very, very grassroots. So up here we're supporting, the KIPP network of schools, and down here we are supporting, we bought four trombones for a marching band in Brooklyn last month, so it's really like really, really different. Why is that? Our mission at Heckscher is a little corny. It's to level the playing field for needy kids in New York City. And we do that through grant making that is very, very broad based. It is in every area. It's health and recreation and camping and arts and after school and education. And I can't even think what I've forgotten. Sports, just an enormous range of stuff, because we believe that are all the various ingredients that help to make happy kids. We think happy kids are resilient kids, and resilient kids are successful kids in school and beyond. So it's a little bit of a corny mission, but again, I think if we look at our own parenting, our own children that we know in our lives, that's a truth. So our funding in that area, even though it may not be in our education portfolio, we really believe in a lot of our recreation and arts programming happening in the classroom and in schools as the laboratory for those things. So there's a lot of overlap there. I have a background in progressive education. I got my master's degree at, and I taught at Shady Hill School in Cambridge, which is sort of a famously progressive school. We went to school in our jammies, and everything was very groovy in the 70s in Cambridge. And when I started teaching after that in the public schools, I was completely, aghast at, these boxes of curriculum that I got, and I got this book that was entitled The Teachable Moment. And I was like, you need a book about the teachable moment? I thought that was incredible. But of course, that is the reality of the public school system. And, terrific that there is a book about the teachable moment, thank God. But it was a surprise to me. And so in my philanthropic work in my career, I've really tried to think about how can we make that more integrated, more natural, more organic way of how teachers are teaching in the classroom. And at Heckscher, I think we've done three things in particular that help to engender creativity. The first is we sponsor an enormous amount of professional development. You are teachers, you know what this is. And we generally trust institutions to tell us what their teachers need, rather than going out and saying, we believe in this, we're going to open up 40 slots here, we're going to pay for it. We believe in schools and organizations and nonprofits coming to us and saying, our staff really needs to be trained in this area. We've done the research. We think this is the best model for us. And we support an enormous number of organizations to do one-on-one or group training for their staff and for their teachers. This is obvious. Teacher expertise and ease leads to creativity and new interests. If you're very, very familiar with your curriculum and what you're doing, you are nimble with it, and you have an ability to open it up, even if it's, whatever, phonics, whatever we think of as the driest, part of the school curriculum, it can be taught with flair and creativity. Another thing that I mentioned before that we're very interested in is extended time and extended day models. The primary research around that has been done out of Massachusetts. If you look at the Massachusetts 2020 website, it's fantastic. And I think that the most interesting part of that work is that extended time and extended day is not just more time on task. It's not just 45 more minutes of math. It's more time for recess. It's more time for teacher prep. It's more time for sports. It's more time to move between classrooms. The whole day is opened out with some freedom for a lot of really neat stuff to happen. And in general, achievement goes up. So that's a nice thing. Yeah, you get a little more math, but you also get all this other great stuff. Now, in New York City, you want to talk about extended time, you're immediately going to start banging your head against the wall, okay? Teachers Union comes in, no, this is not going to happen in New York City. I was working for Rudy Crewe at the school board, that's not right, Department of Education, whatever they used to call it, Board of Ed. Thank you. When we tried to do the first year-round school pilot. Pilot went from 20 schools to 10 to 5 to 2 and then was canceled. Why? Couldn't do it. Not going outside of that time frame. So how can extended time budge outside of some of the more restrictive districts in New York City? We are big believers in really dedicated after-school programming. After-school programming that is housed in buildings where it is knit into the curriculum. Again, not meaning 45 more minutes of math, but a dance program or an arts program or an academic program that builds on what teachers are doing during the day. And where the principal doesn't leave at 3:30, I have been in schools where the principal says, I don't know what they're doing on the fourth floor, but boy, they sure are nice. And they don't have any idea what that after school program is in their building. And then there are other programs where we go in and the teacher and the head of the after school program are sitting down, the staff is integrated during the day, and it is just a beautiful thing to see that this curriculum is completely stretched out over time. And that more kids have more access to more stuff. All different kinds of, you know, intelligences are served that way. And it doesn't have to be the same people, but it's the same ethos over the course of the day. So those are sort of the three things that we think are ways to support creativity. I'll just close with one thing. When I worked for Rudy Crewe, whatever your opinion of Rudy Crewe was, he said something to me that I thought was very, very stirring, and I think it speaks to this creativity question. We were sitting at a meeting where we were talking about like a 5-10 year plan for New York City schools, funding and structuring the curriculum, and Rudy, who was a very big man, you know, whacked his hand down on the table, which I won't do because Jeff told me I shouldn't. And he said, yeah, but what are we doing today? There are 1.1 million kids sitting in chairs today. What are you going to do today? The 5-year plan is great, and I want to talk about it. The 10-year plan is great, I want to talk about it. What are you doing today? And I think it goes back to what I said at the beginning about the scale of funding. You know, we are cheesily proud to say that, you know, 4 more kids in Brooklyn are playing the trombone today than they were 3 months ago. And that's a nice thing, even as we're investing in these more longer term things.
Okay, I had sort of started thinking, well, there's this natural tension between creativity and measurement, and it's the whole left brain, right brain thing, and we've been talking about it for 2,000 years, so that's going to make for a long 6 minutes. But then I realized that actually creativity has 2 different senses, and one is something around free expression, art. But if you look in the dictionary, or at least Google, you also see another definition show up, which I think is a better one for today, which is, quote, the generation of new ideas and/or solutions. It seems to me that creativity, if it's free expression, only applies to people. You wouldn't say the system, the school system is creative. But if you think about it in a way I think you should, which is generation of new ideas and solutions, it can be a function of systems, whether they're the Department of Education, the national funding, whatever. And you can easily imagine systems that allow for creativity at one level, but don't at the other. We're completely flexible as to school size and mission, but those teachers are going to follow this curriculum, or vice versa, right? So I don't think, if you think of it as sort of finding solutions, you know where to stick it. But I also don't think that there's a necessary tension with measurement. Because, you know, we hope, I'm going to steal this line, Charlotte said, money allows for the learning And your vision statement was empower creative learning. So I'm going to hope we can say money empowers creative learning. That you can explore different sorts of systems, longer school days or whatever. And if you find something out there and you have the measurement to put responsibility and accountability at some sort of structural level, you might actually allow teachers to be more creative at the levels in which they operate. That's kind of a hope that I have. And I would say, and I haven't seen two things. First of all, I haven't seen measures for teacher creativity. I think social science struggles to define it, to quantify it. But I would say that if you look at KIPP as an example, the KIPP annual report card just came out, and they cite giving educators the freedom to innovate as one of the five pillars of their success. Now, leave aside what you think of KIPP in particular or charter schools. It seems to me you could have a system where there's measurement which allows for the rigor that people demand for whatever set of political or other reasons or funders demand, and actually rather than being in tension with teacher creativity, which I'm sure you're concerned with, actually allows for a bit more of it. Anyway, that's sort of my brief thoughts on the matter.
So with all of our good intentions, we've fallen a little behind. We are going to collect the questions that you may have written on the cards for future use, which the Teachers Network will take. But let's take a couple of hand-raising questions to the panel on things of interest. And I think one of the takeaways that I have from listening to them is, and it's, I guess maybe it reflects my personal feeling as well. Measurement is necessary, right? Is it a necessary evil? I don't know. But it's necessary, but it's not sufficient. You know, we need to leave room in the way that we think for other forms of thinking about things, of analyzing things, of saying, as Julia said, you walk into the classroom and you know pretty quickly if something good is going on. Right? So, before we close up,